Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association held a press conference in Framingham earlier today, outlining their concerns with the pending police reform bill that's working its way through the House. The Senate passed its own police reform bill last week after a heated debate and a number of procedural hiccups, and Governor Charlie Baker released his own bill last month. Here is Jeff Farnsworth, president of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association, in Framingham earlier today.
Massachusetts has some of the best and most respected law enforcement leaders in the country, bar none. However, both the House and the Senate have failed to recognize that.
So for more, we're joined on the line now by Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies. Chief Kies, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Chief Kies, the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association outlined specific concerns about the House and Senate bills at the press conference today. What are those concerns?
I guess, you know, first and foremost, I mean, they're both extremely comprehensive in terms of the length of the bills. The House bill was over 90 pages, and the Senate bill with 47 amendments turned into well over 100 pages. I think at the end of the day, you know, it just seems as though the language has been incredibly rushed. You know, we have a deadline, or they have a deadline, I should say, by the end of this month. They were looking to get things off, I guess, pretty quickly early on. They seem to stall, and then at the end of the day, we have this language that we're trying to look through and understand in hours, and then formulate a response. So it's been incredibly challenging.
So I want to ask, I understand there's a lot of material in the two bills. That's not really substantive. I did hear some substantive concerns earlier today, and I don't mean to be dismissive. I understand it's a lot to get through, and you're concerned about the short time frame. But there are a lot of very specific proposals in those two bills. Do you have concerns about any of the specific proposals?
I mean, we do. I mean, before I talk about a concern, I could say, you know, one particular issue, which seemed to be the primary issue that we actually embrace. You know, certainly there were three different bills, one initially filed, as you mentioned, by the governor, one by the Senate, and one by the House. And they all had to do, you know, the primary focus, it seemed, they all had to do with a version of what's known as POST, peace officer or police officer standards and training. And, you know, what we were outlining today at the press conference is that we absolutely positively embrace that concept, the concept where officers would need to be certified, and if they run afoul of their training or misconduct, they essentially could be decertified. So this is something we've been working hard to attain for the last 4 years. We actually have a working group that's been dedicated to doing just that, but we've came out on record back in 2010 that this is something that we wanted fully in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
You talked about concern about how voluminous the bills are. You also just gave reference to the fact that you came on record about the certification process, at least at some point back in 2010. I want to ask, is it fair to ask, should law enforcement more actively have embraced reform several years ago and gotten ahead of this curve so that we aren't in this moment now where things have to be done quickly because of the overwhelming demand for this reform? Would that have given officers more control and more say in a paced out reform process?
Well, it's a great point. But at the end of the day, we can only control what we can control. I guess in the form of to that question, has the Mass Chiefs as one organization, has the unions as several other police unions filed legislation that pertains to this? Absolutely. Have we testified in support of that legislation? Absolutely. Have we had various meetings with different members up on Beacon Hill regarding all of this? Absolutely. We have over several years. And like I say, it's unfortunate at times that the political process in our state, and I would guess, you know, perhaps many others, just seems to kind of move at a snail's pace. And again, 2010 to 2020 is 10 years. And this is something we've wanted, and I mentioned about on record, not just because we said we wanted it and crossed our fingers and hoped that it would happen. We filed legislation, testified, and tried to move the dial. Unfortunately, it just hasn't moved until this time.
Qualified immunity has been such a sticking point in both the Senate and the House bill. We've done some segments here on Radio Boston explaining more in depth what qualified immunity is. I want to ask, of all the things that could be sort of deeply problematic or kind of the sticking point, you know, there's banning chokeholds, there's reduced use of facial recognition technology, pushback on police use of military equipment, just to name a few things. Why do you think qualified immunity has become the battleground issue in this legislation?
Well, it started in the Senate, and I would venture to guess, and I could be wrong, I think that many on both sides of the issue do not completely understand it. I, for one, came out on record basically saying it is complicated. I've talked to a number of folks that actually work or defend police officers in the courts and others that represent plaintiffs, and they both have different viewpoints on what is the current state of the law in federal court, and they're actually trying to codify some language and tweak the existing doctrine of qualified immunity that was established by the United States Supreme Court here in Massachusetts by enacting initially in the Senate bill one sentence is problematic. And again, speaking to experts on the issue in terms of what these words actually mean in terms of interpretation eventually down the road by Supreme Judicial Court, no one seems to know. So at the end of the day, all we were looking for was not to push this off, not to involve any type of stall tactic or what have you, but put some experts at the table with a very specific deadline in terms of putting people down, having a conversation, and we're willing to compromise on any language. But I can't dismiss the fact that, you know, it's interesting, you know, that many, many, many folks have brought up qualified immunity, and whether it be any particular issue on any particular bill that we're looking to enact in law or in our state, the question is always, what is the problem? What is the demonstrated need that we're looking to solve? What is the existing gap? And in this case, we don't have any issues, none that I know of, no specific issues where there's been potential abuses of qualified immunity in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Yet we hear the national noise, I know others do as well, and it, you know, it sounds like a nice catchphrase to kind of jump onto and say, why don't we enact it here in Mass as the second state in the union to do so, when in fact there is no specific information as to why a problem potentially exist in our state. We just haven't heard it.
Let's stay on that for a second, Chief Kies. We had our legal analyst here on WBUR on about a week ago walking us through what the issues around qualified immunity are. And one of the things that former Judge Gertner laid out for us is that the way it works now, it is just so likely that a civil suit is going to be dismissed because there is no existing case law to cover these very specific terms of that civil suit. So can you understand why people who might want to be able to avail themselves of the full court system would be concerned if on a practical basis that avenue is not available to them, even if, and I can't support or dispute your claim that there haven't been any problems, you know, so far with that. We know there are a lot of people pushing for reform in this area.
No, it's a great point. Well, the reality is that these cases, they're known as 1983 actions. The vast majority, probably 98% of them or more, are actually heard in federal court. So if there was a bill that turned into a law tomorrow and it limited the defense of qualified immunity here in the Commonwealth, the reality is what it would do is would cause more state law claims to be heard in our state because the federal law would not be affected at all. So the reality to that point that you're making that many plaintiffs' cases are dismissed early on, in federal court that exists. That's the defense. But it never, from my understanding of this particular limited defense, it never comes into play with any issue on the table where there's complaints of excessive force. Excessive force, the doctrine of qualified immunity for the most part, would not apply. Again, I think many folks that I've talked to just over the last 2 weeks, they're confusing what it means. Some folks confuse it with absolute immunity, which it's not. Some folks confuse it with qualified immunity being less than absolute, applies in criminal court, which it does not. So it just has to do with monetary damages. And again, if there is a demonstrated need and we're made aware of it, we're willing to compromise. We're willing to let the experts help us out with language. But we do not want this to be rushed through. That's all. Pretty simple, and on point in that regard.
I'm sure we will continue here on Radio Boston to talk about qualified immunity as we go forward. We're going to have to let you go in a minute. Before we do, I want to ask you one more question in this window of timing, since it's such a strong part of the argument that we heard today. You yourself, after the killing of George Floyd, wrote an opinion piece that acknowledged at least some need for police reform. when we talk to advocates for police reform on this show, what they will often say, and we've heard this from legislators as well, if this doesn't get done now, as you say, the State House can move slowly and we may grind to a halt. Given the passion and what I think from your own article you can understand is some need for police reform, what do you say to those who say, if we take the time, this isn't going to happen, and it's got to happen?
We need to get the certification procedure done in the next 10 days. We have three bills. We have good language in all three bills as it pertains to post. We need to get it done. If there's some of the other issues and you know, no-knock warrant provisions only issued by a judge, that makes perfect sense. It was actually the idea of the Mass Chiefs. We brought it forward. We think it makes perfect sense. To ban chokeholds makes perfect sense. We don't allow chokeholds. We never trained in them. We would never allow them here in this state unless there was a deadly force situation and somebody was fighting for their life. But there's some of the provisions, they're incredibly straightforward. Some of the trainings that are outlined to be mandatory, we have these trainings already. We've had for the last 10 years. So some of that stuff we can check off really, really quickly, but we have to get this certification, decertification provision done within the next 10 days.
That's Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies. Chief Kies, I appreciate you giving us some time today. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So I want to bring in another voice on this now. Listening in on that conversation was Rahsaan Hall, Director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU of Massachusetts. Rahsaan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
So, Rahsaan, we've talked to you a couple of times over the last couple of weeks as these bills have been going through the process at the State House. Let's pick up kind of where we left off. And the first thing I want to do is ask you your reaction to what we just heard from Chief Kies.
I'm a little disappointed because if he's saying that there's not problems, it's because the chiefs aren't listening, particularly as it relates to qualified immunity. We have a client at the ACLU, Ms. Gray, who was tased by a police officer. She was in the midst of a manic episode. Someone called because she was leaving the facility and the officer instructed her to come back. She didn't comply because she was in the midst of a manic episode. And the officer, who outweighed her by 70 pounds, threw her to the ground and tased her while she was on the ground. That is a claim of excessive force that was denied because of qualified immunity. So we have that problem here. Earlier in the day, Chief Kies made comments on the steps of the State House talking about problems that were hundreds of miles away. Well, he might not be that good at math unless he met 100 miles away, because that's approximately the distance from the State House to Springfield, where the United States Department of Justice just issued a report saying that the Springfield Police Department had regularly engaged in a pattern of practices of abuse, particularly its narcotics unit that would use the technique of punching people in the face, which is unconstitutional and a use of excessive force. So we are replete with examples of police overreaches and abuses that need to be addressed. And some of the reforms that are proposed in this bill will get to those very concerns and issues.
So, Rahsaan, I do need to acknowledge I don't have details of the specific taser case that you're talking about there, but I do want to talk about the hundreds of miles away. We heard Chief Farnsworth say that this morning at the rally in Framingham. That's been an argument that we've been hearing from law enforcement, is that the reform efforts here are in response to something that happened in Minneapolis. DA Rachel Rollins has said we are one incident away from being Minneapolis, but I do want to ask you, that one incident has not happened. The George Floyd incident has not happened. Now, I understand that that is not a baseline we should be going for. But where does the relative strength of policing in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus some other states fit into our calculus on reform, in your mind?
Well, I push back against that notion, because if you talk to the family of Uri Stamps, a 65-year-old man who was killed by police when they executed a search warrant in his home in Worcester while he was laying on the ground with his hands up, or the mother of Burrell Ramsey White, who was killed by the Boston police, or Malcolm Gracia, who was killed by the New Bedford police, or Evelyn Barrow Cepeda, who was killed by the Boston police, and any other number of people who were killed by police. I think that we cannot continue to hold on to this narrative that Massachusetts is the best in the nation just because people haven't taken to the streets in the way that they have in other cities, or that the incidents of police killings haven't risen to the national level. Yeah, there may be better training out here in some respects, but when you look at the gross racial disparities and motor vehicle stops, or the number of people who are disproportionately stopped by police, that Boston Police Department was doing FIOs and stop and frisks on, that still shows a significant disparity this year as compared to when we first put out our report in 2015. Or you have a Boston police officer who uses racial slurs against children.
I'm going to stop you there, Rahsaan. I want to follow up there. In the last few weeks, as the legislation has been developed, have you had an opportunity, or the ACLU had an opportunity, to sit down face to face with law enforcement leaders and lay out the types of cases and examples that you just laid out for me here?
We've had some conversations, nothing in particular about specific cases, but this is an ongoing, because I've had the opportunity to speak to be at the table with Chief Kyes in talking about racial profiling and talking about the significant disparities that existed in 2004 and haven't miraculously disappeared. And when we were trying to put racial profiling data collection, attach that to the hands-free driving bill, it was the mass chiefs. And my conversation with Chief Kyes, who was one of the main opponents of those types of reforms. So I don't think there's much value in rehashing those cases, because they'll try to distinguish and say, well, that's an isolated incident, or, well, it's not as bad as what's happened in other places.
So, Rahsaan, we've only got a couple of minutes left. I do want to ask you a couple more questions. The chiefs have said that the House bill was drafted without their input. Do you agree with that based on what you know about the drafting? And do you think that's a fair complaint from one of the parties engaged in this process?
If by their input they mean they actually got to write the bill, then no, it wasn't done with their input. But they have certainly had undue influence in the legislature. The way that police chiefs and police chiefs associations and unions have mobilized to stop the progress of this bill, they have had a lot of input in this process.
Why do you say undue, Rahsaan?
Because they have a built-out network that gives them access and influence to legislators that common everyday people don't have, or even grasstops organizations like the ACLU don't have. They have greater influence in what happens, because the legislation was moving forward pretty smoothly with some really good progressive reforms in place. And it wasn't until the police mobilized in that way that the trajectory of this legislation shifted.
I want to ask you one more question before we let you go, because we have to go to break. We have three different bills on the table now. You've got the Senate bill, you've got the House bill, which will start debate tomorrow. There's Governor Baker's bill, which was unveiled last month. From your perspective, which is the best option and why?
It is a combination of them all, with the strongest being the Senate bill, because it deals with qualified immunity and fixes to the Massachusetts Civil Rights Act. The House has really strong language on the face surveillance piece as well. And I think there are tweaks that need to happen in the creation of a post system. So it's a combination, but the Senate being the strongest.
All right. And that's Rahsaan Hall, director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU of Massachusetts. I appreciate you continuing to engage with us, Rahsaan. I'm sure we'll be talking more going forward. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
In just over 40 days, on September 1st, primary voters here in Massachusetts will go to the polls or mail in their ballots. And in a little over 100 days, the nation will decide if President Trump deserves a second term or if Joe Biden will be president. Here's President Trump speaking on Sunday to Fox News' Chris Wallace about the election.
The enthusiasm for Trump is through the roof.
Even higher. I have mentioned it.
Even higher than last time. The enthusiasm for Biden is non-existent. Everyone knows he's
shot. But the enthusiasm against you is
high. Well, that's okay. That's his only shot. I mean, that's his only shot. I agree. And those people know I'm doing a good job. But there's something in my personality that they don't like. Because, look, nobody's done what I've done.
So joining us now to give us a snapshot of the stakes for New England in this election season is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. He's just back from West Brookfield, Massachusetts, where he's been speaking to 2016 Trump voters. Anthony, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. Good to be back.
And also joining us on the line from Washington is Kimberly Atkins, until last week, WBUR senior news correspondent in D.C. She's now senior editorial writer at the Boston Globe. Kimberly, happy to have you back on the show in your new role.
Good to talk to you, Tiziana.
So, Anthony, let's start with you. We just heard the president claiming that he's got enthusiasm on his side. And at the same time, we have national polls, some showing Biden leading by up to double digits. It seems like we have two Americas right now. You've been out talking to people in the western half of the state. Do we have two states here in Massachusetts about this presidential election as well?
Well, I mean, I think the divisions that are so apparent across the country are also apparent here in Massachusetts. It's important to remember that out of 3 million votes cast in 2016, 1 million of them in Massachusetts were for Donald Trump. So back in 2016, we spent some time in those so-called red towns that stretch across central Mass from the New Hampshire border down to the Connecticut line, and we're revisiting them now. And sure, you find some of the same divisions because the state is different out there than it is in greater Boston. It's more rural. People embrace gun rights. The mills that once provided all kinds of manufacturing jobs are shut down. So this was ripe for Trump's message back in 2016. So we're taking a listen, if you will, to find out what people are saying now.
Kimberly, you heard me refer to some of the national polling. That is a snapshot in time. And I got to go back and remind us all that in the summer of 2016, Hillary Clinton was polling well ahead of Donald Trump as well. You've heard the president call them fake polls, fake news. How reliable are the numbers this year? Have we figured the polls out in a way we didn't, especially given that we're doing all this in the middle of a pandemic and a weird frozen campaign schedule?
Yeah, I don't think we yet know the answer to that question. One way to look at polling is to pay less attention to the snapshots and more attention to the momentum. And when you look at polls over time, over the course of this election, it has shown a clear decline in momentum for President Trump. He's the incumbent. This is looking more like a referendum about his performance. This race is also very different than in 2016. You had two candidates, neither the incumbent, but that both people had made up their minds about, and that both had a lot of negative opinion too. With Joe Biden, you don't have the same thing. And frankly, this election is all about Donald Trump at this point. And so the fact that his numbers are dropping, have been dropping over time, spells trouble for his campaign.
You know, it's interesting, Tiziana, listening to that Chris Wallace moment with Donald Trump. They're both right. I mean, Donald Trump is right. The poll suggests that his supporters are more enthusiastic for him than voters are for Joe Biden. But Chris Wallace is right, and that is there's a huge amount of enthusiasm to vote against Donald Trump. And I found evidence of that in Western Massachusetts just today. I talked to a Democrat who's actually running for office. And when I asked him to make a case for Joe Biden, he laughed. But when I asked him, are you going to vote against Donald Trump? He said, absolutely. And that's why Democrats are energized in this part of the state in a way that they weren't in 2016. So both are true in this case.
So let's talk about the Veep stakes or, you know, the big looming question about who Joe Biden is going to pick as his running mate. There's been pressure for him to pick a woman of color. Biden says four women of color on his short list. There's also a lot of conversation about Tammy Duckworth now ascending on that short list. But we are hearing reports here in the Commonwealth that Senator Elizabeth Warren seems to still be getting buzz as someone high on his list. Kimberly, what do we know about that? Honestly, that seems surprising.
Yeah, I mean, look, we don't know a ton about deliberations within the campaign, but one thing that we do know, and one thing that might make this seem less surprising, is that polling has consistently shown that Elizabeth Warren performs well among Democrats, including people of color. There's this idea that Joe Biden must choose a woman of color in this moment, given the reckoning over race, but polling numbers don't necessarily bear that out. Also, Joe Biden has promised to pick a woman. The woman who performed the best in the presidential primary was Elizabeth Warren. So it seems that would be a big point in her favor as well. But keep in mind, too, that this election, while I always say that voters don't care as much about the vice presidential pick on a ticket, but what this will do for Joe Biden is really tee up the front runner in the next after whether he loses or whether he wins beyond that, the next Democratic front runner in the following presidential election will give them a big boost. So in that case, I'm sure they're moving very carefully. And that's one reason that you've seen Elizabeth Warren be very visible. She's clearly still in this race, but as are other really talented people like Senator Duckworth, like Senator Kamala Harris, and they're all duking this out. We'll know by next month.
Anthony, I'm going to ask you a big old bundle of a question about New Hampshire. The president was supposed to do a rally there, postponed it due to a rainstorm that then wouldn't have affected the rally. But that was on the heels of a rally that did not turn out well in Tulsa, Oklahoma, especially in terms of turnout. But he also restarted his coronavirus task force briefings today, which some pundits had said kind of served the purpose of a rally for him when he couldn't. Is New Hampshire in play, and will the president have to come up with different ways to woo voters in states that are in play if these big rallies are a non-starter due to the pandemic?
Well, in terms of New Hampshire being in play, it's pretty much historically, I mean, in recent two or three, four cycles, it's been in play. The latest polls probably give Joe Biden an advantage here. But yeah, it's in play, which is why Donald Trump wanted to come up and do a rally here. In terms of restarting the briefings and his frustration around these big rallies, yeah, this is a tough business for Donald Trump because he derives a lot of power, you could say. He gets a lot of oxygen from those big rallies. It's where he's most comfortable. It's where he can rev up his base. So the less than huge attendance in Tulsa, the cancellation of the rally in New Hampshire, these are all disappointing for him. Now, the idea about restarting these daily briefings on the coronavirus, it's a huge risk because they didn't go so well for him before, which is why they stopped it, because he wasn't very good at staying on message and he was, you know, saying things that weren't proven and highly controversial. And that's when that contributed to some of the softening of the polls. So it will be interesting to see if he can turn that around and use those briefings as a way to connect with his base and rev up support. He hasn't been able to do it to date, but that's what they're hoping he will do going forward.
Okay, so surprisingly, almost shockingly, September 1st is right around the corner. That is primary day for local races. So let's change our focus a little bit. I want to start with the primary and the race for the Senate seat that's held by Senator Ed Markey. He's being challenged by Congressman Joe Kennedy. We also have a second race. This is the House seat in Western Massachusetts, held by Congressman Richard Neal, who currently is the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's being challenged by Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. Can either of you give me a read of the tea leaves on those two races? What are you watching for? What's important? Are there potential for upsets here?
Well, look,
Kimberly,
Western Mass.
You go first.
Oh, okay. Thank you. The Western Mass race is interesting because it's a microcosmic example of what's happening across the country. You are seeing more establishment Democrats, particularly those who hold chairmanships, being challenged by progressives who don't believe that the party is moving quickly enough and wielding its power in the right way. You saw longtime Congressman Elliot Engel of New York be ousted in a primary challenge, and that's certainly what Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse is seeking to do. On the other hand, Chairman Neal is chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. It's one of the most powerful committees in Washington. So I'm watching that closely. I'm making no predictions, but that is a clear example right here in Massachusetts of a really broader thing. The Senate race is entirely different. You have somebody who is fairly popular in Senator Ed Markey, author of the Green New Deal, and you have a challenger who is not coming from his left, but who is a popular congressman, a Kennedy, and looking to move up. Both of them are trying to make the case as to why Markey deserves to stay or why Kennedy deserves the seat. I talked to folks who are question whether either one of them is making that case. So I think at this point, that's a toss-up, but it's a very rare and very different race that's being playing out there.
Yeah, I
Anthony,
agree with Kim.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I was just going to say quickly that I completely agree with Kimberly. Two very, very different races. I think what Kennedy is trying to do here is sort of present himself as the sort of new generation. I mean, you know, Markey is 73. He's been representing Massachusetts and Washington since before Kennedy was born. Kennedy's 39. So there is a sense that people know that the Democratic Party has failed to renew itself over the years. And Kennedy, I mean, this is what you can say about Kennedy. He looks like the future they a lot of folks have been dreaming of, and his name is Kennedy. That said, there isn't, you know, one iota of difference between the two on policy. So that's what makes this a really sort of difficult race for Massachusetts Democrats to assess.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left before we have to go to a break, and I don't want to miss Maine, because we've got Maine Senator Susan Collins, New England's last remaining Republican member of Congress, who is facing off this November against Sarah Gideon, who is the Speaker of the Maine House of Representatives. A lot of outside money coming into that race. It's a key battleground for the U.S. Senate. What do you make of that race, and what should we be watching for, Kimberly?
Yeah, that race is looking like bad news for Senator Collins. The fundraising against, the nationwide fundraising against Susan Collins began the day she took her vote in favor of Brett Kavanaugh to be confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That race has really galvanized Democrats against her in a really, really specific way, to the point that I was actually a little surprised that she would run for re-election. It would be such an uphill climb. This, too, is a referendum against the incumbent, and recent poll, there's not been a ton of polling, but the polling that has been done is not looking good for her. So I think this might be one of a handful of opportunities Democrats have in these Senate races to flip a seat.
And Anthony, if Susan Collins loses, is this the end of an era, the death of a species, the New England Republican in Washington?
Well, I mean, in fact, it would be, because she's the last Republican Washington office holder in New England. But, you know, I would sort of challenge this idea that Susan Collins represents this sort of this New England sort of moderate species of senator, because she's been pretty in line with Donald Trump. And a lot of her votes over the years have also been pretty in line with conservative orthodoxy. She's done well by dealing directly with Maine voters and making them feel that she's really connected to their issues. But in terms of national issues, the idea that she's somehow a moderate who sort of goes her own way, I mean, it is true that she voted in to save the Affordable Care Act, and that was a key vote, and it won her a lot of support among liberals and Democrats in Maine. But the Brett Kavanaugh vote, and don't forget, she voted against impeaching Donald Trump and said that the reason she's doing that is because she believes Donald Trump has learned his lesson. And there's very little evidence of that. So in terms of her being, you know, the last of a dying breed of moderate senator, I'm not convinced of that.
All right. Well, as the pace quickens towards Election Day, we'll look forward to talking to you both some more. That's Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure, Tiziana.
And Kimberly Atkins in Washington. She is senior editorial writer at the Boston Globe. Kimberly, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Did you see the now infamous picture of the crowds at the M Street Beach in Boston last weekend? Did you hear the news about promising vaccine trials? Do you have plans for fun in the next few weeks and you aren't sure how to do those things safely? Well, let's ask the doctors about all of it. Joining me now to help answer your questions is Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center. She's also treasurer of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Welcome back, Dr. Boucher.
Nice to be with you, Tiziana.
And also with us is Dr. Michael Klompas. He's an infectious disease physician and associate hospital epidemiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Klompas. You can call Drs. Boucher and Klompas with your coronavirus questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so I also love asking the doctors questions about the coronavirus because information comes so fast and furious, it's hard to keep up. And I want to talk about state numbers. The state's releasing 7-day averages, 3-day averages. There's been some confusion about what exactly each of those is measuring, why the numbers are different, why the different kinds of averages. Also, while overall trends seem to be holding steady, some number watchers say, wait, the numbers are actually getting worse. So Dr. Klompas, can you break down for us exactly what we're looking for in these 3 and 7-day averages and what's reliable information?
Sure. So one of the challenges for us is that numbers will vary from day to day, just as a matter of course, because you're dealing with human systems as opposed to perfect mathematical computers. So there's only going to be day-to-day variation. So the challenge is to try to detect a bigger signal out of that noise. And the way to do so is by using those trends. And then when it comes to trends, there's a bit of a trade-off. If the longer period you look at, the more reliable a read you're going to get on a trend. So a seven-day read is going to be more reliable, but it's going to impair your capacity to see very small changes that happen in just over the past couple of days, because what you see in a seven-day trend today is going to be weighed down by what's happened over the past week. That being said, I think it's wiser to look at those seven-day trends because there is so much day-to-day variation and fluctuation that you can't really get a good idea just by looking on a day-to-day look or a three-day look. If you take a look at that seven-day trend,
the longer time window is better.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right, and Dr. Boucher, are you liking the numbers that you're seeing from the Commonwealth?
Well, Tiziana, they have been pretty stable over the last several weeks. And, you know, the dashboard that the governor looks at, we look at every day. And, you know, there's still some activity in our state. And overall, the numbers have been pretty stable. You know, there are some areas of more activity, and that's why it's important to look at this epidemic both locally down to the neighborhood level and up to the city, state, and national, and even world level. But overall, we seem to be holding our own in a gross way, I would say.
So before I go to the phones, I want to ask you guys one more question that is top of mind and in the news quite a bit, and that is about delays in results, either delays in getting tested or, more importantly, delays in results from testing. Some people in Massachusetts have to wait up to a week for results. The Boston Globe reports that the delays are largely driven by a backlog at some of the big national labs due to the spikes in the South. But as one epidemiologist questioned, what good is the testing if you've got such a long lag that people might be out spreading or shedding virus during that delay? What do you two think of the testing lag that we're experiencing?
So I'm happy to jump first. I think it's problematic, no question about it. As you say, most of it seems to be with the large commercial laboratories. And the worry, of course, is that if you do have an infection and it takes you a week to find out about it, that you might not be as good about your isolation, about your quarantining in that interim. I think the guidance over there is that if you're being tested, particularly because you've had a recent contact or you have any kind of symptoms, you should wait in isolation until you get that result. And then in parallel, it's incumbent upon us at all levels, at the individual hospital level and laboratory level and state level, to do what we can to try to and reduce those wait times.
Dr. Boucher, anything you want to add on that before I go to the phones?
No, absolutely. And I think that seeing what we're seeing right now, as we look to the fall, it's more important than ever that we double down on addressing the testing issue so that this will not become a recurrent theme.
Let's go to those phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus question of Drs. Boucher and Klompas. We've got Kath on the line from Westford. Kath, go ahead. What's your question?
Hello there. I have a student that will be returning to UMass Amherst, and she will be living off campus with other students. And I want to get an idea of what is the safest way to transition her into this housing, essentially into a new COVID circle, let's say. Do we pretest, or what do you suggest we do?
Who'd like to take that?
I can take a stab at that. I have a child going back to college also in a very similar circumstance. So the guidance in Massachusetts is to quarantine for 2 weeks upon arrival. And most colleges in Massachusetts are employing a testing program. So I would refer you to the UMass Amherst testing program. I know they have one. And it'll be very important for your daughter to follow the quarantine as well as the testing and other guidelines that are in place. And the schools are addressing the off-campus students as well as the on-campus students, because that whole community is going to potentially be affecting each other.
So Dr. Boucher, let's say Kath's daughter gets there on day one, starts quarantining, gets tested on day three, gets a result back on day five that's negative. Does her daughter still need 9 more days of quarantine now that she's had a negative result from a test?
That is the plan. And so for most colleges in Massachusetts, they will observe the quarantine and have testing. And that's because the risk is relatively higher in what we call a congregate setting where all the students are living together. But again, it's really important to defer to each college's individual plan. We're working with 7 colleges and they all have subtle differences. So, but in general, the quarantine will hold. The testing, remember, is just one point in time during the, what is a 2-week incubation period for this virus.
Anything you want to add to that, Dr. Klompas?
No, I think that's exactly right.
All right, let's go back to the phones then. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Diane from Andover. Diane, what's on your mind?
Yes, my question is about riding in cars with others. I'm a grandmother and over 75, so I'm somewhat reluctant and have not taken my grandchildren in a car with me. What do you think?
Dr. Klompas.
Sure, I'll take a stab at that. Yeah, the risk of transmission, the risk of getting the infection is always a function of proximity and duration. That can be mitigated in turn by mask wearing and by improving the quality of ventilation. So if you're going to be in a closed space or a small space like a car, first of all, I think you want to choose carefully who you're going to be there with. So ideally, your granddaughter or whatever the case may be has been good about isolating and masking and what have you. And then when you're in the car itself, to wear masks and open up the windows, get some good natural air flowing through there. And then I think under that context, the risk should be low.
Let's take another call, 800-423-8255. We've got Deborah on the line from Brookline. Deborah, what's your question?
Hi. I have a son who works with homeless and addicts in Boston. He had COVID. He had 2 negative tests and is back at work. Do I still need to keep him isolated? Can he bring it to me or shed, basically, and get... We've kept him isolated. Can I get it from him now?
Great question. Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, so what important work your son is doing, first of all. Second, you know, he is what we would consider COVID recovered now. So should be of low risk to you. That said, there is some question still about whether people can be, quote, reinfected with COVID. So he needs to follow all the important protective measures when he goes to work, wearing a mask, washing his hands frequently, keeping physical distance, because he's working with what we consider a higher risk group of individuals.
And what is the window to either of you, if someone gets infected, then tests negative and truly does not have the virus anymore, is COVID recovered, as you said, do we know how long that the safety of that recovery lasts? Can that person get it again? And if so, how soon?
I'll take a stab. You know, it's a golden question. It's a question in everybody's minds. I will say that CDC put out a statement on Friday making the remarkable claim that they are not aware of a single case of reinfection so far. Now, the caveat, of course, is that the endemic has only been with us for about half a year, so there's still plenty of time for that to change. But I personally find that to be quite a reassuring message. What we don't know is that the antibody response that people get to initial infection and the other protective aspects of the immune system, will that last for a sustained period or not? So far, so good, but stay tuned.
Let's take one more call here. We've got Rachel on the line from Everett. Rachel, go ahead.
I'm Rachel in Everett. Wondering on suggestions for communities like mine that have been especially hard hit, even as we do see overall decreases in our state in cases.
So, Rachel, is your question what to do in communities that are particularly hard hit in terms of prevention and recovery?
Yes.
Thank you. Who'd like to take that?
I can take a stab at that. So, Rachel, you know, all the measures to prevent infection are as important, if not more important, in your community. And testing is one thing that we're really highlighting. And the governor started a campaign a couple of weeks ago to stand up testing in 10 communities that have higher rates of infection compared to the rest of the state. And they're being offered confidentially and free of cost. And the point of that is to help kind of find those asymptomatic infections and help do contact tracing to snuff it out in those communities that have been hardest hit. But for you, the things you can do are continue to wash your hands, cover your face when you're out, maintain your physical distance, and avoid big crowds. Very, very important, especially in these areas where we have higher rates of infection.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I have a very specific question that I want to ask around kids, especially because we know so many of our listeners are thinking about how school is or is not going to reopen this fall. In a Texas county in the news, we learned that over 85 babies tested positive for the virus. On the other end of the spectrum, the New York Times has reported on a South Korean large study that found that while children younger than 10 can transmit the virus much less often than adults do, children between the ages of 10 and 19 can spread the virus at least as well. How do we think about child's vulnerability for contracting and being sick and as spreaders as we go back to school?
I mean, I'll offer my opinion. I think that we still have sparse data in this situation. The Korean data, I think, told us that people 10 to 19 certainly can be spreaders of infection. And I would just take with a grain of salt the notion that those under 10 might be less prone to do so, because it's all in the context of the social close downs or mitigation strategies that were taking place within Korea, and the fact that
kids
who are...
Which were quite extreme.
In some aspects, for sure. And the other aspect being that kids who are very young tend to be minimally symptomatic in a large fraction of cases. And so the capacity to know who the first person in the household who got infected is challenging. And then, of course, kids who are in their very youngest brackets don't go out on their own, right? They're always with a parent anyway, or with a caregiver. So I think it's actually difficult to tease apart. I think what we do know is that kids under age 10 can certainly get the infection. They can have as much virus inside of their respiratory tracts as older kids or adults, and that therefore there's every possibility that they might be able to spread the infection. Again, I don't think we know the answer to this, but I'm hesitant to suggest that children are somehow a safe zone against spread of infection.
Dr. Boucher, in our last 30 seconds or so, what else can you add to this picture, this growing picture about what we do and don't know about children and the virus?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dr. Kompas said it beautifully, and we still have a lot of questions about children. I think one thing that we have to remember is that while most children are very, have little effect, there have been these rare cases of this inflammatory syndrome that is quite serious. The other issue he highlighted had to do with the transmissibility. And as we think about going back to school and keeping everyone safe, we have a lot of teachers and staff at the schools who may have underlying health conditions and may be older. So these measures of protecting everyone in the community are very, very important, even for small children.
And that's Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center, and Dr. Michael Klompas, an infectious disease physician and associate hospital epidemiologist at Brigham and Women's. Thanks so much to both of you for answering callers' questions today.
Thank you.